Welcome to the Body Wear Living Podcast. My name is Margot Rose. I've been a fitness trainer for over 20 years, and I've created a system of healing called Body Aware Grieving. We're here together today to find practical ways to care for our health during the best and worst of times. And I'm super honored today to be talking with an amazing man, Dr. Barry Rotman. He has a degree in medicine from the University of San Francisco. He was a fellowship at the Veterans Hospital at Stanford University. He was for 10 years a John Muir primary care physician, and he's had 13 years of being in private concierge medical practice. In addition, Barry Rotman is my brother, so I'm really glad to introduce him today and very proud. Barry, wanted to say hi for a couple seconds.
Well, thank you for your introduction. As we were talking very briefly before the record button went on, this is a new format for me to be able to get everything right on the first go around. So I want the listeners to be patient and bear with me as I hope to get some instructive messages out clearly today together.
I'm so intrigued that you've been in medicine for so many decades now. And I know that one of the questions a lot of people have is how can they balance their own self-care while they're sort of feeling like they have all these responsibilities to be caregiving and nurturing to other people in their families, to their pets. People feel like, how can I take care of myself at the same time that I'm trying to balance taking care of other people? And I know that you've had that in your own personal life because, you know, you've been a father, a son, you've had all these different roles in your life. The same time you've been a doctor and handling whatever was happening personally, at the same time you're also trying to make sure you're available to the people in your practice. Have you found something that works better or worse to try to keep that balance in check?
Yeah, a lot in that one question. In thinking about my own self-care and how I recommend self-care for other people, I think the most important first step is obvious, but not always apparent, is we really deserve self-care. I think in so many instances that I work with in my patients, I see individuals that are struggling to care for children, their parents, their children and their parents. They themselves have health issues. And not infrequently, I encounter people that have the approach that there's sort of like a zero-sum game of energy, if you will, where that any moment away from care for a loved one that they might be using to nourish or replenish themselves is time taken away from that loved one. It's a zero sum. And what I try to do to people is make them realize that for them to be the best caregiver they can be, they have to replenish, refresh, recharge their batteries, a metaphor I will use, themselves. So I think the first step to getting people to care for themselves is to recognize the need and that they don't really have a choice. A lot of situations I'm working with people where it's not a week or a month, it's years, and you really have to come to equilibrium.
On the cusp of another discussion that I thought would be fascinating to have with you, part of it is stress and how they manage the incoming amount of stress with ways that they personally can rebuild their well-being. And taking a step back from that even further, we're sort of talking about the idea of resilience. I mean, you're talking about dealing with so many thousands of patients over the course of all these years, and you're watching people that are going through hard times a lot, probably more often than not. There's some, you know, they're not going to the doctor for fun. A lot of times they're dealing with something that's a hardship in their life, or they're helping care for one of their loved ones. Is there a tendency that you've noticed amongst the people who are more resilient versus the people who really get discouraged or overwhelmed more easily during challenging times? What is something that you really sort of can tell, oh, this person's got this sort of resilience that a hardship isn't going to knock them down quite as quickly as, say, somebody else you might see might be right out the gate. This person's going to, you know, need some extra support.
Yeah. I'm going to sort of take that question back to the beginning. And so I've been a doctor now for 30 years and been watching many thousands of people, unfortunately, go through many hardships. And the conclusion I would come to at this point is I think people are more resilient than they give themselves credit for. So what I do, I sort of have my check-in. So unfortunately, many people major loss. They themselves have acquired very difficult to handle news regarding their own personal health status, loss of loved ones. And not infrequently, I'm working people through grief. And so what I like to do is realize that if they can just sort of basically stay safe and move forward and learn some tools, they will come out the other side. I really have faith in this inherent resiliency of people. And so I basically have a checklist, and it's not rocket science. I just will review the basics with people when they're in crisis. And it's very basic. Then we start out. Tell me, are you eating okay? What did you have for lunch? Are you getting meals okay? Are you able to sleep okay? Did you sleep last night? What kept you from sleeping, right? Then we just sort of look for, I always ask about exercise. Have you had a chance to get outside? Have you had a chance to exercise? We then look for evidence that they might be down a pathway that's going to be not good for them. You know, are you still taking your medicines? Are you, you know, have you changed the amount of alcohol or other, you know, drugs that you've been taking? And then we go into safety. If people sort of flag positive on any of these, then we go deeper and try to keep people from harming themselves by any of these areas. Well, no, you're going to really need three meals. Or what can we do to change the structure of why you're not sleeping? We'll talk about sleep perhaps later in the talk. But if you're not sleeping, you're really not in a position to heal emotionally or physically. And so it's an area of interest. And so just going through the basics to make sure people are going to be positioned to move forward is a big part of keeping people moving forward. And then we really go sort of the next level is, you know, what are their social connections? And interesting enough, people who are part of religious communities really have a built-in sense of support, both in terms of their philosophy and the communities that are often associated with religious organizations. They really have a built-in stability that helps them. We look for other forms of social connection, whether it's the family, workmates, really looking for where are sources of strength that people can go to during these hard times. And like anything in life, you take what you can get. I have people who are very, unfortunately, alone in life. The relationship with their pets, never downplay the value of the relationship with a pet. I have patients in my practice who I think are probably being kept alive by their pets. It's definitely a symbiotic relationship. So this would then be a checklist to make sure people are going to have the tools to allow what I would argue probably is inherent resiliency, take them forward if all of these other aspects are handled for them. I don't know that resiliency has to be given or infused from outside of a person, but I think things that will inhibit or hamper it need to be handled so an inherent resiliency can come to the surface and take people where they need to go.
That's a really inspiring idea. So you're really suggesting that some people have better tools, better support systems, but that most people have an inherent resiliency. I think that'd be inspiring to a lot of people who might not see themselves that way at the moment. Especially if a doctor says that he thinks that, you know, most people will have a head start towards knowing how to get through a hard time, especially if they can get more of the tools that they need and that everybody deserves. Going way back to the beginning of what you said, is people first need to really know that they deserve to have the resources that help them function well, and that especially if they're a caregiver and they're putting everybody else in front of themselves, that's just not going to be sustainable. But I really right. love that idea that people are it's not like some lucky people are more resilient. as much as we all have that that we can cultivate within us. I'm wondering also, how many patients do you think you've talked to in 30 years of being a doctor?
Go lost count. Somewhere in the thousands, I'm sure.
There's actually thousands of patients that you've probably seen over 30 years.
Correct.
That's a huge study of people. One of the things I'm curious about is, are there tendencies that you've seen between how men respond to things more often and how women respond to things more often, especially as you've mentioned, like grief and loss? So many people are the family members of your patients. You've probably had a lot of patients pass away in that many years of caring for people. Is there something that you've seen that men versus women respond to better when they're trying to get through stress, and especially if it's related to healing from a loss and kind of grieving, perhaps even a family member who's passing away?
Right. So I'm going to take a step sort of upstream from that question and then float back down. Obviously, there are physiologic and biologic differences between men and women, right? Uh-huh. And also in terms of mental health, you know, men may be at greater risk for successful suicide. Women may have a greater incidence of anxiety disorder. But I think I tend to not accentuate the differences. That is, any problem a man could have, a woman could have, and vice versa. The statistics of who will present may differ across gender, but I don't necessarily divide up treatment plan by gender. In other words, the plan that I described to you in terms of looking for the basics really gets applied across gender. I might be more on the lookout for, let's say, substance abuse and a gun at home and, you know, a middle-aged man, because unfortunately that is the demographic for successful suicide, for example. But I don't really generate different pathways based on gender. So that might not have been the answer you're looking for, but that's how I see it.
So you're saying de-emphasize the gender difference. Everybody needs to treat themselves with the support systems, with the input-output stress level balanced out. Everybody's going to need to know they have a core resiliency within them and cultivate the ways that they need to feed themselves and the people who are going to help support them so they feel well enough to bring it out. And you're saying that there's not a huge thing you've seen between men and women and what sort of works at getting them through harder times. Is that kind of what you're saying?
No, fair follow-up question. You're right. The plan is to come up with a customized outbox for each person. There may be a different willingness, for example, between a man and a woman to, let's say, talk to a therapist. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to be, you know, offered for both. In other words, there may be different probabilities, but the overall goals and checklist is still there.
This is my guesstimate, and it would be delightful if it's not accurate, but I feel like some of the very standard self-care things, especially during loss and grief, that people are sort of advised to do are things that, take a bath, talk to your friends. I think some of those things that, writing your journal, some of those things that are very effective tools seem to be things that more women versus men feel suit them, or they feel familiar with it, or they feel like that's their go-to. It's some of those things tend to be easier for a woman to do, or more, I'm going to take a bubble bath. And then, some of those things seem to be more gender specific in our society. And that's why I'm wondering, wouldn't it be useful if we had a wider range of tools? Do you think we need a wider range of tools as go-to grief recovery and go-to self-care that men have? Yeah, this is me. This is what's going to feel good for me. This speaks to me when someone suggests do X or Y. I think a lot of those suggestions come off sounding like, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you're suggesting those things to people and you find men are like, yeah, that is a
fair enough. I think the tools or mechanisms that a man might check different, but the core principles that I'd be working at would really be the same. So you need 20 minutes where you have no responsibilities to anybody else, and you really want to clear that time to be able to be lost in your own thoughts and relax. This could be a bubble bath. This could be sitting in the hammock in your backyard staring at the trees. So the principle and the goals would be the same. The tools for getting there might differ across gender lines. You need someone to listen to what's within inside of you. That person may be your best friend if you're a girl, or it may be your religious leader if you're a guy. It could be an old friend from your school. So obviously there's a lot of overlap we're talking about here. What I'm trying to say is you really need to take a step back and try to see what the goal is and then work to individualize how to get to that goal with each person. The problem with assuming differences along gender is there are women for whom the quote unquote female advice is not going to be their best. And there are guys for whom the quote unquote male advice is not the best. So by having a wider repertoire of tools to meet these objectives and realizing that statistically, okay, it may play out along gender lines, but you could use the full basket of tools across both genders, so long as you're clear with what you're trying to accomplish with each tool.
Interesting. So again, you're doubling up on not trying to polarize and guesstimate what might work best for a man and a woman. You're really just saying it's all based on the human being and what they respond to best.
Right. So let's look. You're in grief. You need increased social contact. Let's, you and I, the patient, strategize what's the best tool for you to achieve this objective of increased social support. It's working together without assuming, oh, the guy, you know, go talk to your beer buddies. The woman, oh, go talk to the therapist. It's really working together to find a treatment path or set of supports that work for that individual.
Staying with this topic for just another second, specifically around crying as a healing tool, and crying is one way that people sort of express especially sorrow or frustration sometimes, or even anger sometimes. Do you find that fewer men feel comfortable with the fact that it's okay to cry and have like a sort of a practice where they don't mind doing it and a way to feel some of that relief that honestly I think women feel better after they cry a lot? And do you think that's a tool of healing that is less familiar to men or not?
Oh, I agree 100%. On the other hand, then you still need to try to figure out, so crying is just a physiologic mechanism that allows you to acknowledge your own emotions, right? So for those who are not doing that, you have to figure out another way, another avenue, a venue for allowing them to acknowledge their own emotions. For some women and maybe a lot of guys, it won't be a good cry. But you have to look at what you're trying to allow somebody to do, right? You know, kind of the difference between the tool and the objective, right? I think everyone has the same objective. People need different tools to get there. You're right. Crying probably, at least in the society, breaks down much more along gender lines.
Is there something you've noticed that men actually do more successfully in terms of their self-care more often? Again, agreeing that it's not going to be a binary thing.
It's a hard question to answer. Let me think this through and parse it out. Some of it really has to do with understanding the terms of the question, which are that of doing well, which raises a whole new issue unto itself, is what is doing well with grieving, what is doing well with the crisis, and so forth. A lot of men can view doing well is getting on with their lives. Women would feel doing well as sort of emotionally growing and working through and learning. So from a provider, practitioner, support person, our definitions might be closer to the stereotypical woman's definition in terms of, you know, doing well in terms of the grief. So part of doing well for men, quite honestly, is getting them to acknowledge the definition of what doing well is. In terms of thinking of gender differences, I would think I probably had more discussions with men, you know, where I might paraphrase the discussion. Well, how are you doing? Well, we buried Pa, and then they'll give me a litany of all the, what I call the bureaucracy of death they accomplished. And then they were able to give me a list
of death.
Bureaucracy of death. Yeah, that's, I've experienced this personally. I've experienced this watching other people go through. It's really sort of almost punishment or torture we inflict on people when they lose a loved one in terms of all the bureaucratic encumbrances that they themselves have to go to for the first time when they're so weak and they can't focus on it. And the frustration is it looks as if that person's death was the first death ever of all humankind, and that they have to reinvent the wheel with the bureaucracy. That there has to be a better way in terms of sheltering people from all the bureaucratic encumbrance that they get hit upon when a loved one dies. It's a frustrating topic, but we digress. So we were talking about defining doing well, right? So the initial encounter with the man by doing well might include a checklist of what was accomplished and might in no way include any recognition of having to confront their own feelings or a pathway towards grief, and that part of working with more of a traditional male response is quite honestly defining what doing well is in terms of a grief reaction. I think women may start off with more of a doing well definition that is closer to that of the caregiver they're working with. So just understanding the terms of the conversation might be different in that regard.
So doing well with the what did you call it? The bureaucracy of death?
Bureaucracy of death.
Yes. So that's like, well, where's the death certificate? And how do you do that to the insurance company? And you're talking about things like that. Like, oh, well, what about their mortgage? And I think people don't really know all that's coming down the pike. And it can be super adding to that moment being even harder. So if I guessed on some of those things that you're referring to?
It's outside of my bailiwick. It's just I've seen it so many times and personally experienced it that you just say to yourself time and time again, there has to be a better way. You just hear these horror stories of women who lose their husband and they can't even access the bank account and they have a problem, you know, paying the mortgage. And endless instances of these kind of bureaucratic oversights that really shouldn't exist. What can often happen is people are very depleted in the time of loss, and whatever meager resources they have get sucked up and squandered. Well, it's not squandered, you have to deal with it, but get shifted to this bureaucracy of death to the point where they don't have the wherewithal, at least initially, to attend to their own emotional needs. It's a real emotion suck away from what you really need at that time in your life.
Well, that brings, you know, the idea of how to define what doing well means. And, you know, one of the things I like to support, like in the whole body aware grieving idea, is that your first necessity is to just get through today and get through the next few days. And in that sense, I mean, it would be ideal if people were better prepared in advance or about what would be coming next if I lost my partner, if I lost somebody, if somebody also had other proxy people who could take over some of those administrative, bureaucratic, overwhelming things when somebody who's a primary griever is not well. But doing well, in one of my opinions, is that if you just get through each day without having a physical accident or injury, and you remember to feed yourself, and if you get to any of those things, great, that's surviving. Surviving the first, you know, few days and weeks after a major life change. To me, that if you can't get to the emotional stuff right away, but you can keep yourself safe and physically functional and hopefully start beginning to rely upon and skillfully receive from some of the people who might be able to take something off your own plate, for when you're the primary griever, that would be doing well. And I think people feel like, oh, grief is something that happens immediately after, for example, it can be any kind of loss, but loss of somebody that they care about, for example. And one of the things, I know we're not going to go too deep personally, but one of the things when we lost our dad, one of the only really relaxing moments in a really super miserable year was the morning of his funeral, and I said, Margo, you only have to do this once. You have the rest of your life to figure out the grief part. You have the rest of your life to miss him. You have the rest of your life to figure out what you're going to do on Father's Day each year. You don't have to know all that right now. Only once in your life will you need to sit there and at your father's funeral, and that's today. So just get through today, and there's no time limit on when you have to figure out, you know, how do I stop being so sad, or which memories will I take with me, or how do I commemorate this person, and how will I go on? Knowing that you can get to all those things in due time, it took pressure off of, I need to survive today. Today's going to be really hard, and I just need to get through today safely. And sort of reminding myself that the emotional stuff is going to be there as long as I want for the rest of my life. Instead of depressing me more at the time that was hard, it sort of felt like a relief. Like there was no timeline for grief. I can spend the rest of my life figuring out how to remember him and move on in a way that honors him and supports the rest of my life that's coming up still without him. So as it gets back to the person who says doing well is getting through that list of bureaucracy, that's not wrong in a way. Like just surviving and getting through that list of administrative hellacious details is a huge success. That is doing well. So long as people don't indefinitely postpone and try to block whatever emotional parts are going to need attention eventually.
I think people underestimate how impaired they are and how much help they need when they're in the throes of a grief crisis. People are sort of experiential by nature. And so if they've never experienced something, they really kind of don't know what it is. Yes. And I think people really need to acknowledge the magnitude of what's happening to them. And I think that acknowledgement is part of the next step, that people really need to accept help. And being open to that is really important.
What is something that you wish more people knew about taking care of their health? What do you think people could do better if they really got this one or two core messages about how to live well?
People really have to acknowledge they deserve to have the time, the energy, the support from others. I think for a lot of people, they feel addressing their own emotional and physical needs somehow is to the point of selfishness and that they're not giving to others. We alluded to that, that it's really not a zero-sum game. I often tell people, if you don't recharge your batteries, you will not be there with energy to give to those you love and you want to give energy to. And that I sort of almost have to work the metaphor that by strengthening yourself, it's not selfish. You're doing it to be able to give to others. And depending on where people are in that saga, it becomes more apparent. Not infrequently, a crisis will start suddenly and people will throw themselves into it and they will become exhausted. So it starts out, you know, what you could do for a day or two or a week, you cannot do for a month or a year. And I, you know, often see people at these inflection points, and that some deep down level they're experiencing that. But I think perhaps having an ex health provider outside of them labeling it and giving them permission to really work on their own needs is an important part to getting the health care that you need.
So as we're talking to people who are listening today, we have a doctor here who's going to give you permission and suggestions that your own self-care can't be always postponed. Maybe we can quantify for people. If you are seeing or experiencing which kind of thing in your daily life or in your level of function, this is a sign now, not later, is the time to really prioritize yourself. What are some clear external signs that you would tell people who are listening, if this is happening to you, it's time to love yourself more and get other people to help you love yourself more, because clearly you're dealing with a lot.
Right. Well, that goes back to the checklist that I sort of labeled as not rocket science. Many a conversation, it's really basic. Are you eating? What'd you have for lunch? Are you sleeping? How much did you sleep last night? Have you been able to exercise? If you do take prescribed medications, are you still taking your prescribed medications? If there's certain substances in our life that could be overused and detrimental, alcohol, other drugs, are you going down that path? So it's, as I said, it's not rocket science, but there are very clear markers that if you're going awry, it will show up. Are you not able to maintain social connections with people around you? The joke about medicine is everyone could think of all these, you know, long multisyllabic Greek and Latin terms that make doctors sound so smart, but time and time again, I'll come back to one of the shortest words in the English language, which is fun. I'll spend a whole session talking to somebody about what's wrong, and I'll say, but what do you do for fun? Tell me about fun. Are you still having fun? So if people have lost the ability just to have fun, that's a marker of impairment. And so diagnosing that someone's not doing well from an outsider, just listening to the answers to those questions, it usually becomes pretty apparent. I think when any of us, we've all been there, are in the throes of these personal crises, I think it's a lot harder to have that self-knowledge. It's a lot easier to deny. You know, I don't need to sleep. There's too much to do. I don't need to eat. I'm not hungry. Fun. How can I have fun if so-and-so is suffering? There are a lot of ways we sort of say we don't need these things, yet we do. And sometimes having an external person just go through that inventory and list could have a lot of diagnostic value in assessing where somebody is and what help they might need.
That is so beautiful. I had in mind to ask you for a final advice that you wish for people who are hearing this podcast. And I can sort of paraphrase and just say, as of right now, if you needed a doctor to tell you you need to have fun, Dr. Barry Rotman is here to tell you and has just said that even if you're dealing with someone else's long-term, especially if you're dealing with someone else's long-term illness, especially if you're dealing with multiple things that are stressful, whether it's finances stressful at the same time as your personal things, especially the more things you're dealing with and the longer you're dealing with them and the more people who are responsible that you're trying to take care of, you need to have extra attention to your own self-care. And that does include fun that shouldn't be postponed indefinitely. And I really want to double, triple, do a hooray for the advice that Dr. Barry Rotman says, especially when you're going through hard times. Find whatever fits into your own life and lifestyle, whether you're a man. Well, that was really a fascinating takeaway here. The lack of emphasis on gender as a distinction versus something that was a commonality, that we all are going to need that permission to consider our own wellness essential and pursue the well-being, including fun, no matter what else is happening in our life. Is that something that you would sign off on?
100% very eloquent, very valuable information. I think we're all much more resilient than we think. And I think to be able to get down and harness that resiliency, we probably all need more help than we think we do when we're really in a tough situation.
That's so sweet. It makes me cry. It's not like some people are resilient. Some people maybe use it more often. Some people maybe have fewer challenges. But the idea that deep down we are all resilient, and that's just, I don't know why, that just sounds super helpful. Simple. It's not just, oh, some people are going to do well. We can all try to get through these things a little better, and we can all find that place within us that's resilient enough to say, this is hard, but I'm going to do my best to survive it. And you've said multiple times about receiving that help from other people and that cooperation with other people. That's really super beautiful. And so some nice surprises. I appreciate the time you've been sharing.
My pleasure.
When you hear enough patients ask you the same questions over and over, you've started writing articles and blog posts to answer questions that come in consistently. And you were saying that some of these answers to commonly asked questions are going to be on your website if people who aren't your patient want access to some of this summarized wisdom. You said you were inviting people.
Of course. My practice has a website, and the easiest thing is just to remember my name, Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, Rotman, R-O-T-M-A-N. Put it in Google, you'll get to my website. The landing page is all the blogs that I've written regarding the COVID-19 crisis. You can pick a topic you like, wander around in there, hopefully learn something. Anything I can do to help during this time of crisis, I'd like to.
Nice. Are there two or three other topics that you've written about a lot that people, I know insomnia, you were studying sleep disorders.
No, right now there isn't any written content on the website around insomnia. The blogs are really in chronological order. There's not a lot of shelf life. What was the topic for COVID-19 crisis in March is no longer relevant a few months later, but we try to keep it up to date. Every few weeks, a new topic comes out. And I think the tempo of what we're dealing with the COVID-19 crisis is really picking up, both in terms of the tragedy of the rates of infection, hospitalization, and death, which is unfortunately still accelerating, and the hope for the end to all of this in the form of vaccine technology that's rapidly coming to us as far as tools, and hopefully we'll have access to vaccinate more people as rapidly as possible.
All right. Well, I want to super really acknowledge that it's been an enormous privilege to have not just a doctor in my family, but to have, you know, my big brother be Dr. Barry Rotman. So even though I can't individually provide each of you with your own big brother who's a doctor, if he has some wisdom that you've enjoyed today and can take to heart, he really means it. He really means anything nice he said to you, and he really has best wishes for your, you know, what you're going through right now. I know he means that. And if there's some articles on current events and you find them on his website, then you can have your own little slice of my big brother, Dr. Rotman. So thank you so much for your time today. And thank you, Barry.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it immensely. All right.